Good morning. So, last time we finished up covering some assembly topics. We started by reviewing the calling conventions. We mentioned calling conventions were this agreement between people who wrote and used functions about where things like arguments and return values and so on would be, and also about what you have to do about the various registers that the function might or might not use, and whether it's the responsibility of the function writer or the function caller to worry about whether the values of those registers change. We also talked about condition code. So, as typically x86 assembly is taught, you learn, you do something like an if by doing this compare instruction followed by a conditional jump instruction. We went over, well, how does that really work? And we learned that there are these special registers which stored information about the result of the last piece of arithmetic. And you might say, arithmetic, why so general? Because it's not just the compare instructions that set this, but all the arithmetic instructions, just the compare instructions, are just special arithmetic instructions that happen to not write out the values they compute to a normal register. Then we looked a bit at mapping C to assembly. I mentioned sort of the strategy I like using is kind of taking my C code and rewriting it as C with go-tos, because usually using go-tos or if go-to has a very natural mapping to assembly. And after we get it to that form, we can kind of just go line by line and write equivalent instructions. Mention that this is not necessarily what compilers do. Compilers sometimes do things that are more clever. But it gives us a working translation of some piece of C. Now, there's one special case in C that we didn't have such a straightforward translation, and that was switch statements. And for switch statements, we saw that there were a whole bunch of different options which would be viable ways of generating equivalent assembly. We could turn it into a bunch of if-else statements in effect by doing like compare, jump if equal, or jump, and so on. We could do a binary search with the same sort of compare, jump less than, so on. Or we could use this idea of what I call the jump table, which is a table of where the code for each case is, and we look up by what the switch statement is on which case we're in, and where the code for that case is. So, questions about the things we covered last time? Yes?
So, is the difference between a caller safe and a caller safe register just that by convention you want to restore the value of the caller safe?
So, the question is, what's the difference between a caller safe and a caller saved? Is there callee saved ones by convention you need to restore the value? So callee saved are ones that functions are responsible for not changing. Or at least not in a visible way, I should say, not visibly changing. So yes, you need to, so if you use those registers, you need to save and restore their values before you return. Caller save registers, functions are not responsible for not changing. So if you are using those registers and you call a function, you have to assume the worst. And the function just writes the worst possible value for you in there, and you better deal with that. Other questions? Okay. So, since we've looked a bit at assembly, we're going to talk about a bit about constructing programs. I'm going to talk first about how programs are typically laid out in memory. I'm going to give the example of the most common program layout, or sort of layout you'd see, maybe not most common anymore, but a common program layout you'd see on 64-bit Linux. So we've divided up our memory into a bunch of regions. We have this area at the top, which we're going to reserve for the OS. We have a stack, which is where we store temporary variables, return addresses, arguments that didn't fit in registers, and so on. We have a heap, and I write other dynamics. So this is malloc memory, nude memory, and anything that we're going to allocate not on the stack after the program starts. And then we have some writable data. This would be like global variables that are declared normally in the program, and also our code and our constants. And on x86, the decision about the stack is that it grows down, meaning that when we went to add something to the stack, we take our stack pointer and decrease it, and right there, and we keep decreasing it until we run out of space. And as I mentioned, we store arguments, return addresses, temporary values. This is typically where we save registers, even though we could save them elsewhere, and so on. We have these regions in between, which are unusable space. So some of this space is kind of really used under the cover. So I have this region marked used by OS. So as we'll learn later in the semester, often the operating system will take some memory addresses and use them for itself, but in a way where normal programs can't use them. We also have some regions which seem to be not allocated to anything. You might say, that seems wasteful. Like, aren't we wasting a lot of memory? And as we'll talk about when we talk about virtual memory much later in the semester, it turns out that the memory program C is not the same as the actual RAM. There's going to be some translation that happens where the OS can decide, I want the program to be able to use this address, but it's going to really be this part of the RAM. When it goes on the memory bus, the processor is going to send a different address there than the one the program sees. And we'll talk about how that works in a lot more detail much later in the semester. But that's why we can have these gaps and not waste space, because the OS sets up a mapping, and in its mapping, it just has things that don't map to anything. Okay, so questions so far? Okay, so our main topic for today is going to be about this part of the memory. So we have our code and constants and our global variables, which are going to have some initial value. And sort of the simplest model of how we want to program, we have an executable file which contains the program, and we're going to load this part of memory from the executable file. Most simply, and like hopefully for like efficiency, we just like take something that's on disk or similar and copy it to memory right here, and then we can start running the program. We can start running it by jumping to somewhere in that code area. So the question is, how do we get there? So we kind of know what assembly looks like, but there's a few extra steps to take assembly and get something that's in this format, and a few steps beyond just producing machine code. And you may remember from 2150 that we had these sort of different steps that compilers take, that you take your C code, you produce assembly, which we've talked a bunch about, but then you take that assembly code, and you don't have to produce an executable directly. You can produce something called an object file, which on Linux has the extension .o. And you can actually produce multiple of these object files and put them together into an executable. And commonly, your programs are going to be produced from ultimately multiple object files. Because let's look at this simple program here. I have this function printf. You might say, the code for that's in standard io.h. So when the assembly file's produced, it's going to be in main.s. That would be a reasonable guess. But if you look at main.s, you'll find out the code for printf isn't there. That standard io.h just declares that printf exists somewhere, compiler. And the compiler happily generated an assembly file that uses printf, without actually having a definition for it. So your question might be, wait a moment, on this picture, it seems like I'm missing something as far as how does our executable work? Because we have to call printf, how does that work? And the sort of simplest way we can make this work is that when you produce an executable by default, the compiler is going to link in a bunch of extra object files that contain things like standard library code, unless you tell it not to. And one of these, in this example, would be printf.o, which presumably is the source code for the printf function. Or not the source code, the compiled code for the printf function. And we call this process of taking these object files and putting them together into an executable linking. So questions about this pipeline? Yes. Is this related to object-oriented programming? No. I'm sorry that the terms are the same.
Why are we calling it an object? What does that mean?
So the question is, why is it called an object? I am not sure exactly why that term was chosen, but it is the term that's been used for at least 40 years. And it's what you'll see in all sorts of documentation. So it's what I'm going to use. Yes. So the question is, how does standard io.h play into this? So standard io.h is going to contain something like int printf char star dot 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 semicolon, which says there's a function called printf that returns an int and takes a character star argument and some unspecified number of extra arguments. So that's going to be what's in standard io.h. So all the information that the compiler has when generating its main.s is that there is a function that is called printf that takes arguments like this and it has a return value that's an int. So it's going to generate code that calls printf, but as far as knowing about the function is, all it's going to know is that it's called printf. And so the linker's job is going to be to go from whatever's in that object file and somehow make that call to printf work, even though we didn't actually have the code for printf beforehand. Yes?
So if you have a library that has multiple functions, would all the functions be linked, or just the ones you use?
The question is, if the library has multiple functions, so standard io.h has a whole bunch of functions. Are all those functions going to be linked and included in our executable? And the answer is, it depends. Sometimes the linker doesn't have the information to do that. Sometimes it does. Also, as we'll learn later on, I'm going to be explaining something called static linking, where we put all the code in the executable. There's something that you might see done in practice called dynamic linking, where basically this process happens when you start the executable rather than when you produce it. But we'll talk about that after we talk about the simpler static linking. Other questions? Okay. And you may be vaguely familiar with, so for example, with GCC, Clang is probably basically the same. Like, there are options to do this compile, assemble, and link steps. And maybe you're probably, or I guess most of you are probably used to doing something which combines multiple steps. So like if you use a GCC or Clang command to produce an executable from a C file, that's doing all these steps. It's just doing them all for you rather than you having to do each one by one. But like when you do that last command that's there, that will produce an object file. It's just going to be a temporary file that gets deleted when it's done producing the executable. Other questions? Okay. So we have these object files. So a question that's a good, reasonable one is, like, what's in object files? Like, why are they? How are they different from just executables or assembly files? What's the in-betweenness of them? So we're going to look at an example here. It's a simpler example, so it's puts instead of printf, but basically the same. So if we compile this into a assembly file, I got something like this. So this is our actual assembly file. This is in AT&T syntax. Could also have been written in an Intel syntax, but that's not what that compiler does by default. And there's some things which are maybe a little confusing about this. So first we'll go over some assembly things which maybe don't make sense. So one thing you might say is, wait a moment, why the heck are we modifying the stack pointer for no reason? Why did the compiler do that? And the answer is that part of the Linux calling convention that we kind of glossed over, because it's mostly not important because you're not writing much assembly functions, is that the stack address must be a multiple of 16. And because call pushes an 8-byte value on the stack, it starts at not a multiple of 16. So the function needs to correct that. Must be multiple of 16, I should say, whenever you call another function. And we're calling puts here. You might also be some questions about what this XOR instruction is. That sets EAX to 0. It's shorter than moving 0 into EAX in machine code. So then another thing you might be looking at here is there's this text and data. And so what that does is that divides our assembly file into two pieces, one which is called text, which is, for reasons I don't know, basically a historical term for code, and the other is data. And we're going to use this division when we produce an object file. So the object file is going to be divided into a text and a data part for later on. And I've put code in the text part and data in the data part, but I could have written an assembly file which doesn't do that. It just wouldn't be useful later on when we make an executable, as we'll see, probably. So if we produce an object file from this, well, what the assembler is going to do, it's going to turn the instructions here into machine code, and it's going to take the data, the string here, and write it out as, you know, the sequence of bytes that should be loaded into memory to represent that string. So, for example, we'll have our code here represented as machine code, and you might say, wait a moment. There's this call to puts, there's this move of the location of L string, the string hello world. How does the assembler know what to put in for the machine code for those? And the answer is, it doesn't. So we'll see that this machine code is incomplete, and we'll fix that later. It'll also take our data segment and write it out sequence of bytes. Now here I'm showing this as hexadecimal. If we're writing an object file in a real system, we probably don't want to spend 3 bytes of space for every byte. So we'll probably not write it out as hexadecimal in the actual object file. But on the slide, I'm doing that so we don't have line noise or whatever. And there's going to be things that correspond to the different parts here. So for example, the machine code for subtract 8 from RSP are those first 4 bytes there. We have this move into RDI, and it moves the address of L string. And I said the assembler doesn't know where L string is because, well, we haven't made the executable yet. We don't know where that's going to be. So it just puts in a bunch of zeros as a placeholder. We need to have that space filled in the machine code, but it's going to be left blank for now. And the same with the call. The call has a space for the location of puts. We're just going to leave that blank. But not blank, as zeros in this case, which is just an arbitrary choice. But if we're leaving those placeholders, we need to have some way of making sure they get filled in. And this machine code here, this is not something that's easy to figure out what's supposed to be there, because we could have had a move from some other name to RDI. So we need to store that information somehow. So the linker can do its job and fill in these zeros, these placeholders we left. So we're going to have a table of what are called relocations. And they're going to give instructions for later on about how we fix this incomplete machine code. So here we say, oh, they're at byte 6 of the machine code. There's a place that needs to be changed to have the memory address of byte 0 of the data segment. Why byte 0 of the data segment? Because that's when where the L string was when I was assembling this file. So linker, when you figure out where that data segment ends up in memory, you do that. That's what we're telling it. And byte 11 of the machine code has a place where we need to fill in the address of putS. Well, we know what that is. We don't know what that is because there's no putS. Yes?
So if you were to use like a 4-byte integer with the value of 0 in your code for whatever reason, how would it know the difference between that and like a relocation?
So the question is, how does it know the difference between like just a normal 0 and a relocation? So the way it knows the relocations is that this is a separate table. So the linker doesn't scan the machine code for zeros or anything like that. It only looks at this relocation table. If there's no entry in the relocation table, it's not going to change the machine code in any way. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Is the table of relocations directly included in hello.o?
The question is, the table of relocations directly included in hello.o? Yes. It's not going to be like in a text format, but it's going to be in there. And on Linux, there's a utility called Object Dump you can use, which will decode all this information. I think I have. Do I have? Yeah. So. Yeah. So there's a utility called Object Dump, which will give you output like this. I'm showing you something simpler. But it really is there. You can actually look at it if you wanted to. Yes? The relocation table just tells you where in the code segment things are going to be filled in? Yes. And technically, there's no limitation that actually says relocations only need to be in the code segment. It's just that usually that's the cases we'll have. Other questions? Yes.
What is the VF between the two?
The question is, what's the VF between after the sub and before L string? So in x86, we're not going to worry about the real x86 encoding, but this whole thing is a move instruction. Move RDI with the placeholder. It's move 0 into RDI. We're not going to talk about how you figure out that encoding because we're going to learn a different, simpler encoding. But that is the actual machine code for a move into RDI instruction. Other questions? Yeah.
Does the relocation byte come from 1 or 7? Is it byte 6?
The question is, are we counting from 1 or 0? So I'm not going over the quote unquote real format, so I counted from 1. But I counted from 1 here, but that's sort of a decision when you decide also like how this is really going to be stored and the file. But obviously we're probably not going to write it out as hexadecimal numbers to save space. So we'll also make some choices about how we write out the relocations specifically. Other questions? Yeah.
Does the label of the string have to start with a dot?
Does the label of the string have to start with a dot? No. So in Linux assembler, starting a label with .L is a way of indicating that it shouldn't be used by other files. Other questions? Yeah. Can I clarify the What's in what file there?
In hello.o.
So hello.o, we have our the stuff that we're actually going to put in memory, the code and the data, and we have information about ways in which the code we generated was incomplete. Relocation. So there's one more piece of information that needs to be in the hello file, which is going to be known as a symbol table. So for this example, that's less obvious, but if we think about producing an executable, we need to know where main is, because we're going to combine hello.o and printf.o and maybe some other files, or putst.o, I should say, and maybe some other files to actually generate our executable. The linker needs to know where main is, so we're also going to write that down in something we call the symbol table. We're going to say, if you're looking for the thing called main, it's at this part of this file. And so if something else calls main, which is typically how main actually works, is that there's some code the compiler includes that calls main. Now we know how to resolve it when there's a relocation for that. Yes?
The symbol table contains the location of constants that are actually defined in that particular.
The question is, the symbol table contains the locations of constants that are actually defined. So it contains the locations of labels. But in the object file, we don't know where those labels are going to be in memory yet, because we haven't combined it with other things to make our executable. So it just contains where in the file they are, where in the text and data part they appear. So in this case, main is at the beginning of the text part. So we say it's, I guess I'm inconsistent with my byte numbering, but we say it's at byte 0 of text. Other questions? So we have this object file, and what the linker is going to do is it's going to combine it with all the other object files that have the code we need. So in this example, I'm saying standard IO, but maybe there's like multiple object files to implement standard IO. And we're going to generate an executable, and the most important thing that's going to be in the executable is we're going to take all the code from all the object files we need, put them together, take all the data from all the object files we need, put them together. So that's what we want to load into memory. And then we're going to fix up all the relocation. So we're going to fill in the address of the call to putS and the location of the string that we want to load into RDI. And that's going to be our executable. And now that's ready to just copy into memory at that location. It has all the code from both hello.c and from the standard IO implementation. And we can just load it and jump to part of the code. So questions about this last step? Yes.
So you said that the hello.exe is in binary, but it's going to affect the decimal. Is the hello.o in binary too, or is that in decimal?
The question is, this is if hello.exe is in binary, is hello.o also? Yes, typically. So it doesn't make sense to like store these things in a human readable format that's going to be twice or three times as big as it needs to be. Right? You would not be happy if, you know, Firefox was, you know, several gigs instead of several hundred megs. Yeah. So the question is, in the relocations, I have stuff that's, you say, placed in the placeholder. So first of all, note that I'm not placing the actual data, but the memory address of things. So as for what about our input, so remember that this is the process of making something so we can load the program. Everything the program does after it's running is not part of this process. So this is all about preparing us to run the program. So the program can certainly, like, for example, malloc memory after it runs. That's totally not part of this process, okay. Even though that involves putting memory locations somewhere.
Okay.
Yes?
So why do we have the intermediary step of creating the object file?
So the question is, why do we create the object file? Why don't we have a program which goes takes a bunch of assembly files and puts them together? And The process of taking our assembly file and converting it to an object file is not actually that trivial. So this should be more efficient. And probably one of the bigger things is, like, if you think of like the C standard library, we'd like to not keep reassembling the code for like puts every time we make an executable. So we'd like to have that done once and reuse that work, and that's what this lets us do. Other questions? Yeah.
Are the machine codes like line by line in the hello.o like the IBC?
The question is, are the machine codes line by line? So the in hello.o, so in hello.o, the usual format is going to be some information which says there are this many bytes of code, this many bytes of data, followed by that code and that data just directly, because we don't want to do any, have to do any funny parsing to like copy it somewhere. Right? We want to make the linker's job as simple as possible, and that's typically how you'll design your object file formats. Just to make the linker's job as simple as possible, not to have any text parsing or anything like that, because you would like producing executables to not take more minutes than it needs to. Yes?
Is the linker responsible for determining the memory address of the contents, like the string hello world?
The question is, the linker responsible for determining the memory address of things like hello world? Yes. And the reason the linker can do that is because it puts the actual data for hello world in the executable, and it knows how the executable is loaded, so it can figure out that address. Other questions? So, since we've talked about this, here's an exercise. So here I have main calls say hello, asking which files contain the memory address in some format. It might be indirect, but the location in memory of say hello, are likely to contain. Give you a minute, you can check with your neighbor. Okay, who needs more time? Okay, so who thinks A? B? C? Okay, D? E? F? Okay, so I think C is the best answer, but it's very common to think B B and C. And let's look back at our example here and put, and this is kind of analogous to looking at main and put S in this example. If we look at hello.o, is the memory address of main in there? And you might say, oh, well, there's a symbol table and it says where main is, but it doesn't say it in terms of a memory address, and it can't say it in terms of a memory address, because we don't know where main's going to go. If we think about the executable, we're going to have our code for standard I/O and our code for main, and depending on how big that code for standard I/O is, the place of where main ends up being will change. So we don't actually know where it is. It's not even decided, right? We could make a different version of standard I/O and it would end up in a different place. So it's not going to be there based on us having a label for it. And as for having a call for it, well, if we think of like put s, which is the analogous to like the call to say hello in main in this example here, you know, it's going to have a, might have a relocation table entry, but it's going to say wherever say hello is. It's not going to say the location of say hello in memory because we haven't decided that yet. So I think, like, it's at most in C, you know, that's the only place it, thing it could be in. Yes?
Can you explain why the main, the, yeah, the .o file, doesn't contain the memory address of main in that last example?
So the question is why in our previous example the .o file didn't contain the memory address of main? Because we don't know where in the executable main will end up. It depends how, where the linker decides to put the other object file's code where main will end up. So we just haven't chosen it yet.
The symbol table
says where in the object file it is, not where in memory it's going to be. So it's a location in the file, not a location in memory. And yes?
Yeah, so in the example, like in the exercise, for that example, you said that you don't know where main is because
We don't know where it's going to end up, I should say.
Yeah, so like, let's say you switch the problem where instead of like figuring out where main is, we're trying to figure out where sb.io is, like the first thing on there. Would we know it then? Or
so the question is, would we know it if we know it's first? So we also haven't even decided actually which one's going to be first.
Okay.
Because the linker can still make a different decision for that. Yes.
What is the void in parentheses? Like in say,
the question is, what is the void in parentheses here? This is a way in C of specifying that it takes no arguments. In some corner cases, it is different than just having parentheses with nothing in them. This is not one of those corner cases. Yes. So the question is why this, you're confused why it wouldn't be in the object file, the function is static in size. So the memory address is the location in memory. So the location of say hello is in the object file, but not as a location in memory. It's saying it's in this part of the file. But the problem is that we don't know what else we're going to put in the executable, and therefore where in the executable it's going to end up. Because when we make the object file, we don't know any of the other stuff that goes in the executable yet. And in fact, that could change, right? We could make one object file and create two different executables from it. Yes?
So,
the question is, does the symbol table include location in the object file of any label? Yes. We could imagine making symbol table entries for them, but I didn't. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, memory isn't allocated until the executable? Yeah. And that's partly because we don't know like how much stuff we're going to put in the executable until we know how many object files you're actually using. Other questions? Yeah.
When you're actually making the file, you object file on the standard IO instead of giving it as an argument.
So the question is, when I'm doing this using GCC, I never specify standard IO.
Yeah.
So does GCC find that? Yeah. So basically, compilers have things that they link into your executables by default unless you tell them not to explicitly. And that's how the standard library is always available. Other questions? The question is, how do these relocations correspond to using an ampersand operator in C?
Yeah.
So if we think of what the compiler's thinking, the compiler has something and it needs to know the address of it. So if it's a local variable, the compiler knows the address of it because it knows how it allocated space for that local variable probably on the stack. And it's going to not use a label or relocations at all. It's going to do something with a stack pointer.
Okay.
If it's a global variable, it's going to use a label, and that label will turn into a relocation.
Okay.
And there's other possibilities depending for other types of variables. Other questions? Okay, so second exercise. Which of the files are likely to contain hello world exclamation point? Like, and by Literowski's thing, for which of these files would you think if you like open them up in a text editor and control F for hello, comma, world, exclamation point, that you would probably find that? Who would like some more time? Okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, F? Okay, so I think the best answer is E. So we probably need to talk a bunch about this. So main.s, people got, you know, it's probably in there because we looked at what like typical assembly looked like here, and we saw, oh, hello world appeared in there. Now, technically, it doesn't need to be. You could imagine a compiler that does like this in its assembly, but that seems like something you'd hope your compiler would not do, even though it's perfectly correct. So as for the object file, remember I said we want to, the object file is going to be in some sort of format that's convenient to the linker. And while displaying the object file like this is nice for us, if you're writing a program to actually use it, you don't want it in that format. And generally, the most convenient thing to the linker is if it just can do a blind copy of the data and segment into where it wants it. So generally, in the object file, we're going to store the data sort of on a real system where we want things to be fast. In the exact same format, it's going to end up in memory. And in memory, we better actually have the ASCII for H-E-L-L-O, because that's what putS expects when the program's loaded. So it's going to be there in memory. And the way we load the executable is we just copy it from the file into memory. So it better be in the executable as that ASCII ready to be used. You don't want any extra steps. And so that's why I think it's in the executable, because, well, it's going to be as ASCII ready to be used in memory when put is called, and we hope there's no extra steps to do that beyond copying it from the file. So it should be in the executable. And we like the linker's job to be easy, so probably in the object file, we're going to have it in the same format. So it should be in min.o. Questions? This reasoning? Yes. The question is, you thought in the .o and the .exe it was in hex. So I displayed it for you in hex. And we could imagine an object file format which works this way, and an executable format which works this way, and it wouldn't be crazy, but it would be extra work, right? When we load from, if this was our executable file format, loading an executable, you know, when you're like starting your web browser, that would involve translating a bunch of hexadecimal to binary, which would, you know, make something that loads slow load slower. And for the object file, that would make linking slower and also make our object files much bigger. Yeah, so typically it's going to be an ASCII. So indeed, you could imagine formats that are this way. And we're going to, for some exercises, we're going to deal with formats where they are written out in text. But that's not what real systems do, because, well, we're concerned about like making it easy for you to deal with. So yeah, we'll have it written out in text. But on a real system, we're much more concerned about making it fast and not take up extra space. And the format we want in memory is that actual ASCII. So that's going to be the fastest to have it in and the most convenient for writing code that deals with this. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is here, the thing is the string in ASCII, the highlighted parts are the string in ASCII, yes. I've just written it out in hexadecimal for consistency with everything else I've written out in hexadecimal. And I couldn't exactly write out the machine code as text, because that wouldn't make sense. It's not. Other questions? Yeah. The question is, the string stored in the same format in all the same files? Typically, yes. So like if you, I guess, so as a concrete example, like if you open up your BOM executable and search in a text editor and search for, say, the password for phase one, you'll probably find it because it's in there in the format it's going to appear in memory, and which is the same way it appears in a normal text file. Other questions? Okay, so I mentioned at the beginning that this process of producing an executable from everything together is something called static linking. It's called static linking because we do all the work statically once when we make the executable. There's an alternate approach called dynamic linking, which is actually very common. And the reason I taught static linking first is because even though dynamic linking is these days more common, the way I like thinking of dynamic linking is that it's like static linking, but we do part of it when the program starts. So rather than combining all the code together when we make the executable, we do some of the combining when we make the executable, and we do the rest later on. And the most common use for this is to have common code that's shared between different programs be loaded at runtime. So for example, you know, I have like 1,000 programs on my laptop that use printf. And it would be really annoying to have 1,000 copies of printf. So to avoid that, instead, we'll set up the programs to load from a common file, which on my laptop is going to be something called libc.so, the copy of printf, and call that when it's used. And basically, you can think of this as doing the last some of the linking when the program starts rather than when we make the executable. Typically, when you see this for efficiency, they actually use a little extra indirection for this. So for example, commonly calls to printf will actually be cased with like a table lookup, where is printf, so they don't need to replace all the calls when you load the executable. They just fill out a table, and they arrange when they make the executable to have calls to printf use that table. Some questions about this dynamic linking idea? Yeah.
So for static linking, static in this sense just means it all happens before the program starts?
Question, static linking means it all happens before the program starts? Yes. Other questions? Question, if I restart the computer with the same program, got the same memory? So the addresses the program sees are, well, they can be fixed like in this diagram here. They might not be in practice. The actual real addresses, as we'll learn much later in the semester, it doesn't really matter. Other questions? Okay. So dynamic linking, I said, is very common. So on Linux, there's a utility called LDD, which lists all the things that are used in dynamic linking. So for example, if I run it on ls, the list to directory program, it tells me that ls loads these files. Each .so file is a library that's loaded at runtime. So it actually uses a lot of stuff through dynamic linking that it loads at runtime when you start ls. And this output says the name of the library file and the actual location on disk, because part of supporting having one version of printf is that we wanted to make it the case that we can have the library file, the implementation of it, be in different places on different systems and still have the executable work. And also it says where it ends up being placed in memory. That's the thing in parentheses is, when we're doing the dynamic linking, where do we load this extra code in memory? Okay. So one other detail that I kind of glossed over. So like when I talked about linking initially, like I kind of ignored, I said it was all happened when we made the executable, but that's not true. Another thing I implied was that when we have these placeholders, we always fill them in with an address. And that would make sense if our machine code always put addresses in things like call instructions. But for example, the call instruction machine code on x86-64 doesn't have an address, it has an offset. It says call a function that's this many bytes later in memory, or this many bytes before in memory. So you might say, how does the linker deal with that? Well, we just need the linker to use the memory addresses it knows, because it knows where in memory the relocation is going to be placed, because it knows where it put that code in the executable, and it knows where it put the code for the thing that's being called in the executable. So it can do the subtraction, and we just have some extra information in our relocation table saying, oh, but don't put the memory address here, put the difference. But if you like look at real object files, you'll see sort of annotations telling the linker to do that. So any final questions about linking? So that's all my, yes. So the call instruction would be encoded as, something and 4303. And the linker would need to fill in 4303 in the executable. Does that make sense? You're asking, how does this actually work in machine code? Yeah.
How does it know it's not going to end up out of bounds of the program?
The question is, how does it know it's not going to end up out of bounds of the program? So do you mean how does the linker know that when we have to fill in this like gap, which I put 4303 in, that it's not going to be too big?
No, it's going to be like in a different part
of the memory. So the question is, how does the linker make sure it chooses the right number? So remember, the linker knows where this call instruction that it's filling in is. because of the relocation table set. It's at this part of this object code, and it also knows where it put the thing that it's referring to. So it can make sure it did that computation correctly, as far as what the difference is. That answer your question? Other questions? Yeah.
Could this be like computed at runtime?
Question is, could this be computed at runtime? Yes, it could, but typically it will not be. Other questions? Okay, so that's about linking. So for the remainder of today, I'm going to talk about some issues with C. So this is probably mostly review. So we're going to use C a bunch, talk about C, so C code examples. And for clarity, we're going to assume a 64-bit Linux C environment where chars are 1 byte, shorts are 2 bytes, ints are 4 bytes, longs are 8 bytes, floats and doubles are 4 and 8 bytes, and pointers are always 8 bytes. This might not be true everywhere. In fact, it's not true everywhere. There are systems where there are different sizes. We're just going to ignore that for this class. And we're going to deal with C code, and there's some little quirks of C that might come up at some point in the semester. So one of them is how true and false values work. So C doesn't really have a bold type. Modern C kind of does, but it doesn't work like the one in C++. And in particular, one way it doesn't work like you might be expecting is that the expression, say, x equals equals 4, you'd say, oh, that's a Boolean, right? No, it's not. It's an int. And it's 1 if it's true, 0 if it's false. So you might say, OK, so 1 is true, 0 is false. What is like 2 or negative 1? And the rule in C is that 0 is false. And this is the entire list of false values. Comprehensive. Now, there is kind of a weird case here that null pointers are false, but null pointers are pointers you get by converting 0 to a pointer. So 0 is the false value in C. Every other value is true. So negative 1 is a true value. So another thing that comes up in C is dealing with pointers, which should be review, but some things I'd like to talk about to make sure we're clear about how things correspond to sort of assembly. So for example, here I have a string hello that, you know, is going to be in a variable hello, and that's a pointer. So that's going to be stored on the stack or in a register, and it's going to end up pointing to, well, some read-only data. It's going to be in that data segment that's loaded in the program. And it's going to store a pointer to the H. And the way strings in C work is that we're going to have this null terminator here at the end of the string. And when we have a pointer like this, you're probably familiar with that you can like do hello index 2. Can also do arithmetic. So hello plus 0 gives you hello. Hello plus 5 advances by 5 characters. And if we think of memory addresses, this is fairly straightforward, because if we say hello is located at some address and we add 5 to that address, we get where hello plus 5 is. We can dereference this to get sort of the character there. And this looks very much like the indexing you're used to. And in C, this is, in fact, how that indexing operation is defined. So the way the people who wrote the specification for what C is defined what, you know, square brackets do is exactly this type of arithmetic. Some questions so far? So the question, if I were accessing this, would it read until I found a backslash 0? So it depends how you're accessing it. If I'm doing something like this, well, I'm only going to read one character. And if I add like 50, I'm going to go beyond the \0. If you're using a function which expects there to be a null terminator or that \0, like say puts, then it's going to read until there because that's how that function works. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay. And when I say these things are defined that way, so this means that that square bracket syntax and that pointer arithmetic and dereferencing are exactly the same. And this is true even if foo is declared as an array. So there's a rule about arrays. Arrays do what is known as decay into pointers. So if you have an array declared in C and use it like a pointer, it'll turn into a pointer to its first element without you doing anything. The opposite is not true. We'll talk about how that matters a little bit. Now you might say, wait a moment. So this makes sense for chars, but you know, sometimes I have arrays of things that aren't characters, but you told me that like adding 5 to a pointer added 5 to the memory address. So how does that work? And the answer is that adding to a pointer depends on the size of the thing pointed to. So for example, here I have a pointer to an int that points to the beginning of numbers. So I make a pointer that points to 10, and then I add 2 to it, so I end up with a pointer that points here, advancing by 1, 2. And it advances by 2, even though that's going to be 8 bytes in memory. And the rule is that when you add to a pointer, it adds based on the size of the thing it's declared to point to. So this adds 8 to the address, and when the compiler generates assembly, if it's turned into an add instruction, it's going to be an add of 8, not an add of 2. So questions? Yeah. The question is, could this be on the quiz? Yes. Other questions? Okay, so since we're doing pointer arithmetic, let's do this little exercise. Okay, who would like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. who would like more time? No. Okay, so who thinks it's A, B, C, D, E? Okay, we have pretty good consensus about C, which I think is correct. I'll do very brief since we have pretty good consensus. So the way I figure this out is that I just say, oh, here we have our FOO and a null terminator. We have pointer, which initially is set to foo, so it points to the beginning, because when we have an array and use it as a pointer, it turns the pointer to the first element. We set that to B through that pointer. Then we add 2 to that, so it now points to the second O. And then we do pointer of 0, which is the same as adding 0 to the pointer and dereferencing it. And so that's accessing that same second O. And we put a Z there. I think it would be better style to write star pointer instead of pointer index 0, but they are both legal. And then we have star foo plus 1. So foo still is the beginning of the array. We can't change that. I think it would be better style to write with square brackets, and that changes that to an A, and that's how we end up with pass. So questions? Yes? The question is, do I have to account for the terminating character? And this, it didn't matter, but, you know, I probably wouldn't want to give any of these answers if, like, we overwrote it with something that wasn't a backslash 0. Yes? The question is, the reason I can use foo like that because arrays decay to pointers? Yes. Yeah.
So will that backslash 0 automatically be put into memory when you make the declaration, like on line 1?
The question is, did the backslash 0 put into memory when you make the declaration on line 1? Yes. That is part of how string literals work in C. Other questions? Yeah. So if the question is, could I overwrite the backslash 0 to make it like a different string? So yes, now there's no, I don't know what's after it. So like if I passed it to put s, that would be an error on my part because put s would be accessing memory outside the bounds of an array. But it would be legal to overwrite it and it would make it store an extra possibly useful character. Yes. So the question is, does put s work by looking for that backslash 0? Yes. And so do pretty much all the other string functions in the C standard library. Other questions? Yeah.
There's a reason though you can write pointer equal to star pointer equals to because you have the decaying to pointer.
This is the reason I can write star pointer.
Like star pointer equals foo instead of pointer equals foo. Because foo would be a character and pointer would be a pointer, foo that character.
So is the reason I can write pointer equals foo because of the decay?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So it looks like from this that arrays are the same as pointers, right? In this exercise, I could have replaced foo with a pointer to the beginning of that array, and everything would have behaved the same. But there are some differences that sometimes come up. So you can assign pointer to an array. We saw that. And it's the same as getting a pointer to the first element, which you could write out more explicitly like so. You can't do the other way around. That won't compile. Also, when you ask the size of an array, it's not a pointer. And so the size of an array is the size of all the elements put together. The space it takes up in memory, the size of a pointer, even if it points to an array, is the space a pointer takes up in memory, the size of an address. And this commonly gets people, which is the biggest reason I'm mentioning it, like don't take the size of pointers to figure out how big something is that it points to. It's not going to work. And it might seem like it works because, well, oh, you know, could be an array of size 2. 2 ints, 4 bytes, but no. Okay, so questions about relationship between arrays and pointers? Okay, so guess I'm going to skip over some slides I have. And last thing I'm going to talk about is sort of C definition. So for some programming languages, like kind of what the programming language is basically, oh, there's an implementation and that defines it. Like most people think of Python as whatever the Python interpreter lets you do. So C and many other languages don't work this way. Someone wrote down a specification of what C is, and there's actually been a whole bunch of versions. So there was a book that was published in 1978, which was the original version, commonly called KNRC, which looks amazingly different from modern C. Like, function declarations look completely different, and so on. And later on, this was standardized by the American National Standards Committee in 1989, is what is commonly called C89 or C90. And if you've ever seen the minus ANSI compiler option, that's what it's referring to. And then a later version was up-standardized in 1999, called C99, which added some features you may have thought were always part of C, like slash slash comments. Yes, they weren't in the prior versions. You have to use slash dollar comments. No, I don't know why. And also declaring variables in the middle of a block, as in the previous versions of C, you couldn't declare like an int except after immediately after some curly braces. So like the version of C you're used to is probably closer to the C99 version. And there have been some updates afterwards with mostly much more minor things for as far as you're concerned. Now, these standards define what C is so that multiple compilers can implement them. And some of the choices they make maybe don't match your expectations. We're going to look at a brief example here. So here's a function that tests whether number plus one is greater than number, and I pass int max to it. And you might say, okay, int max plus one, that's going to wrap around, so that's going to be false. And when I use my compiler, say GCC, compile this without optimizations, it can print out false if it's zero. Remember, things return zero for false, one for true. If I compile it with the same compiler with optimizations, it returns one. You might say, my compiler's broken. And okay, well, let's look at the machine code, the assembly code. The optimized assembly code my compiler generates doesn't do the comparison. It just returns one. The unoptimized one, the less optimized one, actually does the comparison. But I say, this is wrong. The compiler should be doing the comparison. Like, it's giving the wrong answer, but the people who wrote the C standard said no. The compiler's allowed to do this, and their decision was, well, you should be able to make that always be one. Right? Why should compilers have to worry about that wrapping around? And they made an explicit decision that wrapping around for signed integer addition is undefined behavior. And the compiler can do whatever they want because you shouldn't do that. And you can see exactly why the compiler would want to do that because, well, it's very convenient to be able to optimize that function to not deal with that stupid quarter case that almost never comes up. And there's a whole bunch of other things that work this way. So we have integer overflow. This is also array out of bounds. It's undefined behavior. The compiler can do whatever it wants. They said, we don't care if the compiler does something consistent there. They can do whatever, divide by zero. And notice that, as in this case, it doesn't need to match your expectation about being consistent, about being the same between even different options to the compiler, even though this doesn't match our model of going from C to assembly that we're used to. That's where I'll finish up today.